Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 12th. I'm Ray Graff. Today it's gardening, and we welcome Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum, Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, Bob Graves from Fadigan's Nursery, and Dale Isla Riggs from the Berry Patch. If you have a gardening question, get in the queue early. These are popular shows. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. Fred, Bob, Dale Isla, and Greg, and your gardening calls coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. The gardeners are back, and they're ready to take your calls. Bob Graves is co-owner of Fadigan's Nursery in Latham, New York. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. Greg Ward is the main head honcho at Ward's Nursery, a gardening destination in Great Barrington, Mass. Dale Isla Riggs is owner and operator of the Berry Patch in Steventown, New York. You have a gardening call? This is absolutely the time, as we have two or three open lines left. Soon it'll be very busy. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email, and the number is 800-348-2551. Welcome back, gardeners. Here we go.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here.
Happy almost spring.
You know, Dale Isla Riggs, you were missing in action the last time, and you went someplace really cool.
Yes, I did. I got to see my first ever Winter Olympics.
Oh, how cool is that?
19,000 people in the biathlon stadium every single race. They were sold out, and the biathlon events accounted for 20% of ticket sales in the entire Olympics.
Now, you know, I know that they're shooting and bang, bang and everything, and it's not the most, I would think ski jump would be more exciting than biathlon.
According to 19,000 people every day, that's not the case.
Wow. So does the biathlon, every part of it occurs in the stadium?
Nope. The shooting occurs in the stadium, and the penalty loop and the start and the finish. Mm-hmm. The skiing is out on the course. Yep. You can be out on the course watching people out there, or you can be in the stadium, which is what we like to do because everything changes with every shooting. And it is just an amazing thing to me to know that people are out there. Their heart rates are 180 to 230 beats per minute while they're skiing on the course.
And nobody drops dead.
Nobody drops dead. And they come in and they quote unquote slow their heart rate down so that they're shooting, usually start shooting when their heart rate is about 180 to 190 beats per minute.
So that's what now you've shooting? Explained why, because I saw a little of that, and they show the heart rate. And I said, why are they doing that? What's, what's the deal?
Yeah, 180 to 190, and that's when they start shooting often.
Are you a biathlete?
I would love to be a biathlete. I am too crappy a cross-country skier to be a biathlete.
Okay, fair
But
enough.
I'm a good shooter.
Well, the shooting's no problem.
When'd you get back?
I got back yesterday at noon.
You got back yesterday and you're on the air.
I am.
Wow. Well, thank you, Dale Isla. And somebody else who's been traveling is Greg Ward. Where have you been?
Well, I went to Costa Rica for 2 weeks. And
Why?
I didn't see any shooting, but I saw quite a few birds. And the flora and fauna are pretty amazing. It's very diverse natural environment.
You're really a serious bird watcher.
Yeah, slightly obsessive, I think is the best way to describe it.
Well, that was great. So how many birds did you catch?
Yeah, we're in the for this trip about 290 species we were able to identify.
Wow.
Went with my wife and then another couple, and we all are avid birders.
That
some more
so
than others, but all avid.
Wow.
Bob Graves, how's Latham?
Hey, you know, I've been traveling. I go to work and I go home.
Yeah, me too. That's what I
go to work and I go home.
It's fun. It's fun, though. It works out. Fred Breglia, how are things over at the Landis?
Yeah, well, you know, spring's in the air for sure. We lost an incredible amount of snow. We had a snowpack that was a really impressive one this year. Great cross-country skiing, snowshoeing. Lots of people had a lot of good fun. But
boy, that melted fast.
A couple of days, and now
I had the Mohawk River in my backyard the last few days.
I believe it. I saw some of the ice flows on it. It was impressive going over the going over the Twin Bridges. It was like
wow.
That was it. Looked like Alaska with all those.
Yeah, I'm just upriver from that.
Wow, impressive. So
we have a stack of email here, so we best get to it. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Joseph and Byrne writes, I'll soon be pruning my fruit trees. Is it okay to apply fungicide while I am pruning?
So, you know, generally I would prune and then apply, or I think apply and then prune. But, I don't think I'd
do
it
the same
day because you don't want to get that stuff really on you. You'd rather just kind of one or the other.
You might be doing your horticultural oil early too.
I would prune and then horticultural oil and then fungicide after that.
Okay.
There's no point in wasting material on something you're going to cut
off. That you're going to cut off.
The only thing that I think you would do early for a fungicide would be you could do peaches with a copper sulfate.
Pearl.
Yeah, and you do that when it's dormant. So prune and then spray. But everything else, definitely horticultural oil.
Meg writes in, greetings. The euonymus hedge along the side of my house has been infested with the scale for a couple of years.
Yep.
Can it be treated, or is it better to remove the entire hedge? If I treat the scale, what time of year would be best?
You can control that with a horticultural oil. You have to give it a good spray, maybe do it a few times, but you could almost do that any time now when you get a decent day, not when it's really cold or windy, but you need to do it again.
It's Gardening Today, 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Dale Isla Riggs, who's just back from the Olympics. Greg Ward is back from Costa Rica. Bob Graves is back from Latham. Fred is back from Esperance. I never leave. Mark writes in, I did not cut back my ornamental grass last year. What do I need to do to make sure that it flourishes this year?
Cut it back. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not too late to do that.
Nope.
You can even wait another couple of weeks. But
you could.
Just get your...
Actually, nice to not cut them back early because you have a lot of beneficial insects overwintering on them.
That's true.
So.
And it also helps accumulate snow around them, which is good for insulation.
Yeah, especially it kind of protects the crown of the plant, especially if you don't know how the spring's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, anything goes right now, but if it gets
started, it's still
fluctuations,
March.
Right? Temperature fluctuations are what we look at. So a lot of times at the Arboretum, we don't actually cut that stuff back until you're really past that, cold snap.
Madeline writes in, hello, I'm an amateur gardener hoping to get my horticulturalist certification. Any recommendations on where to take courses in the area? I'm not even sure where to start.
Oh, yeah. Berkshire Botanical Garden offers a whole series of courses with a certification, and then UMass has a 2-year degree at the Stockbridge School.
Okay. Catherine writes in, this is for Dale Isla, and anyone with a memory of this, and I remember the taste of this. Catherine writes, greetings, Dale Isla, remind me of the name of the favorite cherry tomato that all the other gardeners chose as the best. It might have had chocolate in its name. I'd love to grow some. And that's from Catherine in the Catskills.
My recollection was that it was black cherry, but also everybody liked the chocolate sprinkles.
Yeah. I think the black cherry was the one.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And can you get those seeds?
Yeah, they're pretty easy to get through the standard commercial suppliers, especially ones that cater to home gardeners.
Okay.
Yeah, and plenty of time to get them because tomatoes, we don't want to start too early. So it's...
All right,
schedule.
We have one more email here, and then we'll take a break, and then we have a very big announcement. 800-348-2551, then we'll hit the phones. Nick in Woodstock writes, are partial shade and partial sun the same?
I love that question.
Really, it's,
yes and no. Part sun, I mean, the thing is, a lot of times there's a lot of variation. So, I like to think, a lot of people say things are shaded. And then when I look at it, it's actually getting a lot more light there than you think.
I like to talk about what time of day it gets sun or shade, too.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's another good one.
Partial sun in the morning's one thing, and partial sun in the afternoon is a whole different thing.
Yeah, my idea of partial shade is that you're probably more shade than sun. And I think if you're part sun, you're probably more sun than shade.
Yeah, I think actually it's about the plants, too. So there's a lot of plants that would... really prefer not to be in the sun in the afternoon, as Bob was suggesting. And then there's a lot of plants that need not that many actually, that need full sun to actually perform the way you think they should perform. So they need a very long day. Doesn't have to be the complete day, but a long day. And then there's a lot of plants that just need some part of the day, and it could be morning or afternoon.
Yeah. The amount of energy that comes from the sun between 11 and 4 is way different than earlier or later. You know, a few hours between 11 even and 3 is a lot more than some other times.
Yeah, and then there's also filtered light. So that's kind of like you're not really getting a lot of sun, you're not getting a lot of shade, and a lot of plants you can be grown in that sort of that filtered light.
And prefer
condition.
That.
And prefer that.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and there's also in plant physiology we talk about percent light saturation.
Yeah.
And most plants will actually are able to achieve 100% photosynthesis at just 50% light saturation. So like we put 50% shade cloth on our greenhouses during the summer because it reduces the temperature for our strawberries and raspberries, but they're still getting full, they're getting enough light.
Enough light to complete full photosynthesis.
You know, I think Nick might have meant that as a joke, and we got a good solid bit of time out of answers.
You know,
you guys.
You can find all kinds of answers. You can look it up and say, well, this is a certain number of hours, and this one's a certain number of hours, and this one's a certain number of hours. And
years
we're too literal, I think.
Years ago, meteorologist Mike Landon retired, and I think I did the exit interview with him for Midday Magazine, and he said, you know, I never say partly cloudy, always partly sunny. Yeah, you see? I don't know what that means, but let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number, and we'll get to the phones in a moment. 800-348-2551. Stand by for a stupendous, monumental announcement. Horace Silver, Nutville, here on Vox Pop. 800, how appropriate. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and we'll get to the phones in just a moment. This is hot off the presses, people. I've been instructed to announce this right now. Vox Pop's gardening show with the gang is going to take it on the road to the Landis Arboretum on Earth Day, April 22nd at 2 p.m. So you come on in, you join us. The All-Stars will be there. You can bring your odd plants, your most fertile questions. I didn't write the copy. And dish the dirt with our agricultural experts. It's going to be fun. You can be in the audience for this broadcast. We'll record it, and then we will air it. I think the target date is Memorial Day. We'll air the thing. We'll get it all chopped up and ready to go. So all you have to do if you're interested in going is head to our website, wamc.org/on the road. WAMC.org/on the road. Who's sighing? Was that you, Bob? You can't take this? Believe me, it'll be fine. It's all good. Fred Breglia, you're going to be the host for the whole thing. I'll host the show, but you're going to host the event.
Absolutely, yeah. We're looking forward to it. It's we got a great venue, $2 million view, maybe more. It's an incredible view over the valley, and it's got great acoustics, so...
Yeah, and if you're a fan of the gardening show, this is a perfect time. And, of course, the seats will be limited. So do it as soon as you can, wamc.org/on the road. And now, if we've dispensed with our social media duties, we'll go back to the show. 800-348-2551. Don't worry. I'll remind you about this event in the future. Let's go to Durham and our pal, Carrie. Hello, Carrie.
Hey, Ray. Twice in 1 week.
Yeah, how about that? Welcome.
So my question for everyone is, I have a currently planted double flowering Rose of Sharon that I got at Fadigan's. It's gorgeous, but the deer have found it, and last year ate 90% of the blossoms right before they were going to pop.
Yep.
So I'm planning on moving it closer to the house. What I was thinking of putting in its place is a redbud tree. Okay. Will the deer go after that as well? It's a beautiful middle of the lawn, bright, sunshiny spot.
So at the Arboretum, we have a lot of redbuds. And I will say that they are pretty deer resistant. We don't get much browse on redbuds. They don't have that big fat bud that they're going to be after to eat. generally overall pretty good. If you are moving that Rosa Sheridan and you've had a problem, deer sometimes are not too afraid of the house. So you may, and that's a plant that actually doesn't have the flower buds on it yet. It's going to actually produce new growth and then form a flower bud and flower. So at that stage of the game, you may want to be thinking about, hey, it's starting to grow. Start thinking about a deer repellent. You can make it at home.
Yeah.
And we have, I think on our website, we actually have like a do-it-yourself recipe, landisarboretum.org for that.
And you could could move that pretty soon now. I mean, the weather, the ground's thawed out really quick.
As soon as that ground starts to get workable, you know, you could move it. And but I would caution you to still protect it, because closer to the house doesn't mean.
I have a bunch of other Rose of Sharon, the regular variety, over by my driveway, and the deer never bother them at all.
Huh.
So I was going to put it over by there.
They may not have found them yet.
I would suggest the only thing is with the red bud, you know, because it's a new plant, because they tend to wander by that area, is to, you're probably going to be fine from April through October, but when you get to October, you might want to put something around it in case the resident male comes by and wants to rub on it. That kind of thing can happen like in a, you know, right overnight, and all of a sudden it's really damaged.
I have seen them
do
horrible damage.
And just for the winter, even for a couple of months, you know, right into December, and then you're probably going to be fine. And as the tree gets bigger, it won't happen.
Yeah, and then we always recommend those Vollgaards, because sometimes deer are not the only thing that can mess up a new tree. So anything that's young, relatively smaller trunk diameter, we put this, it's called hardware cloth. It's not cloth, it's metal. It's got like quarter inch half inch size holes. And we make a little collar. We sort of dig around the mulch and drop it down a handful of inches, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 inches, and then anchor it down. And again, not for the growing season. This would be like, you know, October through like now.
And wear gloves, Carrie, because
it does poke
yourself up pretty good. The number here is 800-348-2551. By the way, Greg, I did not ask you, what is this lovely plant you brought in here?
That's a hellebore, or a Lenten rose, that, since it's blooming in the spring.
Nice. Beautiful.
These are really fun, really sturdy perennials that will take partial sun or partial shade.
as well as filtered light.
Or filtered light, quite nicely.
Come on, you guys.
They're pretty fun. So the buds would, if you go out in your yard, it's just melted, right? All the snow is gone.
Yeah.
The buds could actually be sitting there right now on the ones you have planted before.
Yeah. They're remarkably hardy. And, I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, and they'll start to pop. The foliage from last year will be kind of maybe still green because the snow covered it, but also brown, and that can gently be removed.
And I haven't seen the deer eat mine either.
They're very, very deer resistant.
They are deer resistant. They're
long bloom in the spring, and then the foliage is just this really nice dark green mound that nobody wants to eat.
I love it, and
they spread.
It is. It's one of those plants that looks like it's kind of tricky to grow, but actually is a relatively easy plant to grow and does really well, and it's hardy.
The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Gardening with Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, Bob Graves, and Dale Isla Riggs. And now let's go to Westford and Renata. Renata, you're on.
Here we go.
Here we go.
Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. We're off to a flying start.
We've had a big rambling garden. And that includes, you know, food crops and flowers and herbs and a good dog running around. But as we age, I've had to pull things closer to the house. And so now I'm confronted. I have the things I want to grow, and I have a couple of beehives, and I have a big old compost pile. But I'm getting worried about the critters that want to go in there and forage around. So somebody said, put some lime on it, but to decompose it faster. And I'm not that sure about that. I don't know. I want to keep the earthworms, you know?
Yeah.
And I do use the compost well around my cabbages and all my different plants. So I was wondering, what's the best way to confine that compost so that I don't have squirrels and mice and whatever else wants to get in there, deer or bear, you know, from getting in.
Yeah, I would recommend a metal, galvanized metal fence. I mean, we actually are dealing with this exact same thing right now at the house. We started the new compost pile, so it has more of the fresh stuff, and we've noticed eggshells in places where we didn't put them. So we know there are definitely critters in there. My wife just said the other day we got to get a fence around that, Fred. So that's kind of my two cents. I think a fence is best. It's easiest. A couple of stakes. They make these stakes that actually have, if you don't want to pound hammers, they make stakes that actually have like a sharp point, and it has a little like a flat platform for your foot. And you can, in the spring, it's real easy. You just stick them right in, and they make two different kinds. They make more than one kind of galvanized fencing. They make this green stuff that's really light and easy to cut with metal cutter, cutting pliers. And they make the silver stuff that's real heavy. For something like that, you'd probably be all right with the green.
That would keep out the larger animals. You may need a little hardware cloth, as you said, around the bottom. For your voles. And the other thing I get when I do that is rats.
Yeah.
You got to be careful with the food scraps.
Watch out for the rats, Renata.
Yeah, and we don't generally add any kind of like, I know you can add like more like food, but we don't do that. We do, the eggshells are where we draw the line.
Yeah, all winter you're putting in all these table scraps that are not going to decompose, but now that we're getting towards spring, throwing some additional carbon materials in there, getting some of the weeds or that maybe you're cutting down your ornamental grasses, and you could mix that in there, and that will certainly discourage some, especially if they're getting covered up. And then turning the compost in while it's warm, you don't have to get carried away, but just mixing it up a little bit more as you go.
In
the warmer weather, maybe April, and definitely May, June, July, will make that compost break down more quickly.
Okay. Dale Isle, you want to chime in here? All right, Renata, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Gardening Today. Greg Ward and Dale Isle Riggs and Bob Graves and Fred Breglia and Joan in Schenectady. Joan!
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing good. A very quick question. I just want to say, did you catch Bullseye today? It was really good.
I did hear part of that. I heard the John Cleese part where he was awesome. Great.
Cleese was good, but I gotta say Eric Idle and Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
They had me laughing the whole time.
Yeah, it's a great show. I was preparing for this show by the time the second half of that one was on, so
I felt for you, Ray. Yeah. I did. I felt for you.
So what's happening, Joan?
Hey, just one other quick aside. I had the joy of teaching a very young neighbor how fun it is to stomp in quality mud. When you know what was in the soil the previous year, oh my goodness, we had fun.
Wow.
And you could tell exactly where the frost layer was. No problem. He screamed and said, but it's cold.
Aha. Well, that's free entertainment. Good for you. That's great. So
I love my neighbors.
What
Here's
do we
my
have?
Question.
Yeah, that's it. Go.
I have what may be an ornamental grass. All I know is I really liked it last year. But I thought I should check to make sure it's not some kind of invasive evil thing that neighbors would go, why does she do these things? Not that they do that.
Okay.
So anyway, it's very grass-like. It's about 3 feet tall. Lots of space on the stalk between each single blade. So it might be 3 to 4 inches before the next blade. And the blades all appear to be roughly opposite. And it swishes in the breeze, and I don't know if it's a sedge. I think it's a sedge. I did the little thing where you feel it with your thumb on the edge.
Yeah.
So gardeners, any idea what it is?
All right.
Joan, it'd be great if you had a photo. Now, I know it's not in color right now. It's all old foliage. If it's still standing, which the winter probably not matted it down, but if it's still standing,
I cut it back, yeah.
Okay. I think that's going to be a little tricky. So you didn't plant it. It came in on its own. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Self-sown.
And 3 feet tall is pretty tall for anything that comes to mind that would not have been planted, but there's possibilities that it's a switchgrass. Those will get 3 feet tall.
Okay.
There are a couple of sedges that can get 3 feet tall. They're pretty uncommon and usually in wet areas, not in upland areas, that they're usually a little shorter there. So I think we need to see it when it leafs out, and then we can go from there.
Well, Joan, thank you very much. Is that good?
Yeah, I'll keep it for now. And, like, I never get rid of anything until I'm sure I should.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's gardening today. The whole gang is here. And let's go to Bob in Warwick. Bob, you're on.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. I have a 15-year-old weeping ornamental cherry tree, and it blooms every year. It looks good. However, since we've had it, it is, I call it amber. It's like this, it's like a thick sap that gets harder. And the bark and the base of the tree, about 2 feet up, has split apart, exposing, I guess, the inner part of the tree. And I was wondering, is there anything I can do to slow this down or prevent it from taking the whole, you know, killing the whole tree?
Mm. And you're seeing a noticeable split on the trunk?
Yeah, on the base of the trunk, yes.
Yep, so possibly a frost crack. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. You
cherries are really susceptible to that.
Yeah, I mean, at 15 years old, you're past like any kind of borer. It's a big tree. So they're, you know, it's not that. And if you're seeing a split, pretty. So a frost crack happens when you get one side of the tree kind of warmed up a bit. It happens during the cold. And it'll start on a sunny day. It'll start to get some sap flow, some, you know, moving in that part of the plant, and then it gets cold. Then that sap flow freezes, and then it creates a crack, and they're almost always vertical cracks. Now, a lot of times with those frost cracks, they heal on their own. So I should say seal. Yeah. Trees don't heal, they seal. So what we want to see along that crack, and if it's not too wide right now, it's probably minor. You'll see new wound wood being produced on both sides of the crack, and then what the tree's going to do to seal that injury is the wound wood on the left and right is going to kind of grow together, and once it fuses, you're back to good again.
The trick to preventing that is to keep the sun off of it in the wintertime. It's that sun warming it up that does it. Yeah. You even see some people paint the
facing the east. Yeah.
Yeah. Some people will paint the trunk white, or you'll wrap it with a white material not plastic, because that'll make it worse.
Bob, what would you paint it with?
Well, there's paints you can get that are not harmful.
Yeah.
And, you know, not that I would do that, but I've seen it done.
Yeah.
But
you're
always thinking with plant material, I got to keep it warm. No, unless you got to keep it cool. You got to keep the sun off of it.
Yeah, the thing is, it's so cherries, there are trees that have thick bark, and there are trees that have thinner bark. And trees that have thinner bark, like cherries, are a little bit more, susceptible to that. So the trick is to prevent future damage. You just wrap it, not this time of year, you wouldn't wrap it till, you know, the dormant season, and it would be, you know, you would get a tree wrap that would be that would shade that part, and like Bob said, keep it cool.
And there's really nothing you'd do about it now.
No, the tree will probably close itself up pretty readily if we can avoid.
This is sizable, you know, split. I mean, this is 3-4 inches wide.
Yep, it could still close. So it's not going to be a single year close if it's 3 or 4 inches wide. So now that you said that, I would say that this time of year in the spring, coming up soon, it would be good to probably give it a little bit of a balanced fertilizer, something like Plant Tone would be probably pretty good. And what that's going to do is it's going to give it a little bolstered nutrition, so it puts on a little bit more growth. But I would avoid Tree Tone only because it's so much nitrogen-based. So Plant Tone's a little more balanced. And then the other thing you can do to help it would be if we do end up in a drought situation, the tree that has an injury like that, it's going to have a little bit harder time pulling in water.
Okay.
And you're going to want to give it some supplemental water, deep watering once a week, but only during drought. So, you know, it depends on how the season plays out.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, a couple minutes before the next break. So let's grab one more call, and then we'll check the email bag once again. Aaron is in Schenectady. Aaron, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
I just wanted to check in and see what the suggestions were for preparing soil. And I wanted to try doing sugar snap peas from seed this year. So when I should do that.
Dale Island.
What I should do maybe to prepare my soil a little bit more.
Wow.
Yeah, so the first thing certainly is to pull a soil sample and get it sent into Cornell or one of the labs where you are. If you're in a different state, your land-grant university can do that for you. Find out what you might need to add for some nutrients, and those results will come back on the soil test. Any organic matter that you can add to the soil is always a good thing. So if you have leaves left over from last fall or something like that, to get them incorporated once the soil dries out enough that you can till it. And sugar snap peas are great. You can plant them nice and early. The seed packets will say anytime that the soil's over 40 degrees. I like to wait till it's a bit warmer than that, even for peas. And I would wait until it's like 45 or 50 degrees. Uh-huh. And you can just do that by sticking any old thermometer in the top 2 inches of soil. But get that soil test done now. Now that the ground is thawing, it's a good time to pull some samples, and you can get the results back in a couple weeks.
Greg Ward.
And then just so when you're doing those peas, there's a couple things. Of course, it wants to be a nice sunny spot, and you want to soak them. It should probably say that on the plant. You want to soak them for a few hours before you plant them. You can plant them really close, like 2 inches. It'll probably say that on the package too. And then you want some kind of support, even if they're only going to grow 2 feet. If you get the short ones, you still need something for them to grow on. And it's good to have all that in place when you're ready to plant. Otherwise, you're kind of working around them awkwardly, possibly.
All right, Aaron, we have to take a break. It's Gardening Today with Greg Ward, Fred Breglia, Dale Isla Riggs, and Bob Graves. We'll be right back. Kenny Burrell on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551 is the number. Gardening Today, Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dale Isla Riggs, Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, and Bob Graves. And let's check the email bag at voxpop@wamc.org. Honestly, we have more emails than we can get through right now. But remember, we are now in the warm weather months, and we'll be doing this show every 2 weeks. So 2 weeks from today, we'll do it again. And then you get in a little earlier, and maybe you get in. Mary writes, I ripped out a section of stilt grass by its roots this past week. What can I plant to outcompete it to replace it? I know it'll try to come back. Do I need to change the soil too? I hate stilt grass. And that's from Mary. Bob Graves.
That's going to be tough. You're just going to keep working on that all the time, aren't you?
Yeah, it is a tricky grass. Pulling it is effective. So stilt grass is usually growing in, non-maintained areas, sort of in little pasture areas. So certainly you've worked up that soil. If I would actually maybe remove lots of what's there so that you're getting all the stilt grass out at the same time. So it's clean. And then I would put in other meadow plants. You could put in some other native grasses. You could put in some little blue stem, and switchgrass, which I mentioned before, both native grasses. You could put in something that's going to give you a little color, maybe some rudbeckias, maybe some monarda, some bee balm, just different things that are going to sort of take up the space. But I think, I don't know how big the space is. I assume since you're working on it, it's not huge. And I would probably try to continue to work on that first before you plant.
All right, this is from Pamela and Troy. Last year, I asked about a growth on my service berries, which made some of the berries look like the pictures of the COVID viruses, red and spiky. Thanks for bringing that up. Your diagnosis was some kind of fungus. What's the best thing to do this year to prevent that? When, what, which, how, etc.? And that's from Pamela. Dale Isla.
Service berry and a fungus.
Because they're a native plant, they should be able to deal with whatever fungi they're getting. The fungi is probably also a native fungi.
It's usually just on the fruit that it's a problem.
It is. You'll see it on the leaf as well, but generally it doesn't make the leaf
worry about it
much.
That much.
So it's really more of an aesthetic.
Yeah. Birds like the berries anyway.
Yep.
I mean, if you're concerned, right, you can do what we're recommending for fruit trees. You could apply a horticultural oil early, and then you could apply a sort of broad-spectrum fungicide post-bloom.
Either maybe a sulfur or copper like that.
But really, those are generally things not needed to do. The plant can deal with it.
It's in the apple family, so it's getting the same thing apples get.
Yeah, it's cedar apple rust. So the alternative host to that, it needs like a juniper. And we say cedar, but there's no real true cedar. It's actually a juniper. So if you have junipers in your yard and service berries in your yard, you're going to get that apple rust, and that's what you got on the fruit. Again, doesn't hurt the plant, but it does make the fruit unpalatable for people.
Yeah, and certainly the local cooperative extension offices, you can get information from them as far as the types of things that can be sprayed if you do decide that you want to apply something. But it's always good when it shows up. Actually, make sure that there's a positive ID done, and you can take that to your cooperative extension office as well and get it positively ID'd, and they'll help you out with some solutions from there if it.
Okay.
Yep. And it is
really
a fungus.
All right. One more email for now, and then we'll jump back to the phones. Suzanne writes in, I live on the edge of a wooded area. We have a problem with large, spreading, wild blackberry bushes that have taken hold at the edge of the lawn and forest. They have the biggest, sharpest thorns of any plant I know. My husband wants to rent a brush cutter, then kill the remainder with Roundup or some other pesticide. I'd like to find a more environmentally friendly means of killing the roots. Any suggestions? That's from Suzanne.
The first suggestion I would like to make is that there are pollinators that like to live or winter in blackberry stems, native pollinators. So leaving some of them would be beneficial to, you know, to the native area that mm-hmm. you have. Mm-hmm. So just reducing them. The brush cutter is definitely going to bring it back. And if you pass over with the brush cutter a second time in, you know, so doing it in April, May, and then doing it again in June, July, you will definitely limit the total size of the area.
If you can keep mowing it, don't use a herbicide.
You definitely wouldn't need to use a herbicide. No, it could control that.
Roundup wouldn't do it anyway.
Yeah. So just keep cutting it and make sure, especially to cut it in that it's not very tall by late August, and that you cut it in late August, because late August, early September is when plants start sending their reserves down to the roots for the next year. Yeah. So I would cut it three times during the summer.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you want the blackberries? Aren't they delicious, blackberries?
They are delicious. Sometimes the bears and other things will get them first.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they can have some different viral diseases that can go to some of your other plants that you might not want.
They do have really nice fall color, though.
Yes,
right. They do. Yeah. But if you are going to control it, it's mow it early, like Delilah said, not late.
Let's go to Claremont. Scott, you're on the gardening show. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Ray. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Great. We have a field. It's about 2 or 3 acres. It's an old field growing in with the invasive roses and honeysuckle and stuff. What's the best time to cut it? This may be relevant to the previous question, actually.
Yeah, same answer.
Same answer.
Yeah, I mean, cutting it this spring, you know, if you haven't cut it, would be certainly helpful. And then a repeat cut, as we were saying.
I've got a field like that, and I've got to do it at least twice a year. Be nice if I could do it three. It just keeps coming back if you don't.
Yeah, but once you kind of get that pattern together and it starts to reduce it, then you can get by. I mean, at the Arboretum, we sometimes will do it every other year, you know, depending. But it's after you control it. If you got a lot of woodies, if you got a lot of, we have a patch of black locust that keeps coming up. That's like you guys said, twice a year for that.
Any patches of goldenrod that are exclusive, you know, those you could sort of skip because they're pretty good at keeping other things from jumping in.
Great.
Super good for,
I love the goldenrod.
Super good for pollinators.
Yeah, we have a lot of goldenrod.
Yep, super good honey.
So mowing, you know, kind of mowing in a kind
around.
Of, yeah,
yep.
You know, a pattern.
If I mowed now, it'd be before the birds have nested. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, you got plenty of time. Probably well into early May before you have to worry about that.
All right.
Right, and then I would do it again after the birds have finished nesting, so like mid to late July, and then I would do it again late August.
Okay. Let's go to Amherst, and it's Helena. You're on.
Hi. I have a question about bulbs. I didn't get them in the ground last fall, so can I plant them this spring? I know they won't blossom, but I'd like to get them in the ground.
It is really late. If the bulbs feel viable, they're not all dried out. Then the answer is maybe. And if you can, if you can't get them in the ground right now, potting them up, I think we've mentioned this before, but actually putting them in a container with some some potting soil, wetting them down, and just setting them outside on the ground in a shady spot, even doesn't have to be anywhere in particular, so that they can start to root. They need to root for, generally they need to root for about 13 weeks before they send up a shoot. So they need a winter that's 13 weeks long, and then they come up. We don't really have much of that, but it could still be possible as long as you get them rooting right away.
You have nothing to lose except your effort.
Right, right.
And they should feel like a nice, firm onion, you know, something that you're, you know, like almost you could dice them up and put them in a sauce kind of thing.
But don't do that.
If they're, you know, don't do that. But if they're dry, yeah, they're
dry. No, I won't eat them.
All right, you got a second question, Helena. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, the quick question is, I was told that bark mulch is not good to use in a garden. Is that true? And if it is, what else could I use?
So
this is not a vegetable garden. It's a flower garden.
Yep. So we at the Arboretum don't really use a lot of bark mulch in our garden. We use like a compost type product and weeding, a lot of hand weeding.
Bark mulch can be used in a flower garden. It isn't that you can't use them. It's that usually you're tending the soil as well as the plants during the season, and it's inconvenient to have the bark mulch in the way and potentially work it into the soil. But that said, you know, as a low maintenance kind of thing, a bark mulch can be effective
really helps.
A perennial garden or a woody plant garden. And as you said, usually not a good idea in a vegetable garden.
Sometimes people get the idea you shouldn't use it because it robs the nitrogen from the soil, but that's more true of wood chips. We used to use wood chips or the chipping from trees, but we don't do that anymore. The bark isn't as much of a problem, and really it doesn't take that much nitrogen anyway, and you may be fertilizing the area.
That's true. Even the wood chips actually have been proven not to take nitrogen because it needs the wood chip, the raw wood chip, it needs nitrogen to in its decomposition process. But the thing is, the nitrogen is in the air. So a lot of times we were thinking, you know, don't use the raw wood chip, but the research is actually out that it doesn't actually take it from the soil. Now that's different from sawdust. Sawdust would get right in and it would mix with the profile of that soil and it would pull nitrogen from the soil. So in that case, you wouldn't use it. But it would, in any case, in order to put a bark down thick enough to stop weed suppression, you're talking 2 to 2.5-3 inches, that layer would probably not be effective or good in a perennial garden where you're cultivating that soil. In that case, you're going to get lots of little weeds coming up, and you're going to get them up and around wood
chips. Sometimes it's hard to get enough material to mulch an area if you don't use bark mulch because it's what's readily available.
True.
Sometimes it's just hard to get enough of
something. Yeah, and so just to recap, if you're doing a lot of work in the garden, you're going to be moving things around, putting some annuals in there all the time, then you know, going light with the bark mulch or not using bark mulch because you're in there taking care of everything
right,
all the
you're
time.
Cultivating it.
If it's set and it, you know, it's pretty well established and you're not going to do a lot of work, then adding a mulch of any kind is helpful.
All right, Helena, thanks for the call. Let's see. Very quickly here before we jump back to the phones, Jennifer in Glenville writes, is it too late to cut back raspberry canes? I have a raspberry patch that only fruits in one area twice a season. I'm not sure if cutting back the rest of the patch will help it flower and bear fruit. Any ideas?
So since it's bearing twice a year, that's actually what we would refer to as a fall-bearing raspberry, that you're letting the second-year canes stay, and that's what's giving you the crop earlier in the year. It's not too late to cut them down. If you want the summer crop, you would just cut out the canes that you can tell had fruit on them last fall and or last summer. Mm-hmm. Cut those out. The ones that had fruit on the very ends, you just cut off the tops of those where they had fruit in the fall, and then those will put out side branches that produce the fruit for you this summer.
Okay.
And the new canes that come up from the soil will produce berries in the fall.
It's so tricky to tell people how to do that, isn't it?
It's very tricky.
It's really interesting.
I every now and then I think, you know, I should just do a pruning workshop.
That's a good idea.
With these fall raspberries so that people can learn how to tell the difference.
The canes that are going to be removed will be dry.
They'll be very brown.
There's no life in them, whereas the ones that you might want to keep so that you get some fruit in July, if you cut them, they'll be green and you can can check the tops rather than too far.
Right. And the ones that produced during the summer will be branching versus the ones that produced only in the fall and therefore will produce again this year will be one straight cane with the fruit at the top.
Right, I saw you taking notes. You took some notes.
In my head.
Okay.
And believe me, by the time we're done in about 3 minutes, I may have forgotten. But for now, it's very interesting. Janet in Albany, you're on.
Hello?
Hello. You go ahead.
This is, yes, I'm calling about a ancient white pine in the Western Adirondacks. It has sawdust at the bottom. It is growing next to a 50-year-old log cabin, and there's a family discussion going on about should we remove it or can we leave it, and how do we tell? If it falls, it'll undoubtedly involve the camp.
Wow.
Yep. So, you know, in those kind of cases, that's a case for, you know, I would say a consultation by a certified arborist. You would definitely want to get a professional in there to look at it. There are things, in a lot of cases, we've been advocating more towards things, lots of ways to keep trees up and make them safe. And one of the ways is if you think of these big trees as really tall levers, let's just say this tree had to go. It's like, you know, it has some structural issues. They find it. A lot of times that isn't always a, we got to take it out. It just means shorten the levers. So if you think of these big trees as levers, if they're really tall, the lever has a lot of room to pull and push and potentially fall with winds. And, you know, that's an ice storms and things like that. They can get it. But if you shorten that enough, theoretically, it can't almost, it's not almost not possible.
So chop it from the top?
Well, you would reduce it. It would be a reduction.
All right.
And it only is if the in the case if it has some problems. But that's why this one would be, you know, not something that I would feel like answering that
without seeing
it. So this would be a thing where you would want to get a consult. Now, if you're not sure of where to go, depending on where you live, there is a website put out by the International Society of Arboriculture. It's free, and it's called treesaregood.org, and you can look up certified arborists in your area, and you can search by zip code and
Treesaregood.org.
Yep, and you can find an arborist and, you know, get a consult, because before you make a move, it's like, you know, at least get a professional
good
opinion.
Plan.
Somebody right. that's designed to keep, the, you know, people that are employed to keep trees up.
All right, we're just about out of time here, but Marita in Ulster County, and we'll go 12 seconds, 20 seconds on this answer. What kind of roses can I plant to stop Japanese knotweed?
No. Well,
that's a bad start.
No, the answer is not. Yeah, there's nothing that you can plant to stop it. You need to stop the knotweed first, and we've talked about that a lot. Mowing is one of the great ways to deal with it. Certainly, hiring someone to deal with it is a possibility.
That's a good plan.
My neighbor dug some out and then put a tarp down over the top of it, and took what he dug out, put it on top of the tarp. And
it started growing.
He's getting there. It's still coming into my yard, but I keep mowing it.
All right. Bob, if people want to find out about Fatigan's Nursery, how do we do that?
Yeah, we're on the Troy Schenectady Road, about 2.5 miles west of the Northway, 1140 Troy Schenectady Road, Latham.
Greg Ward, Ward's Nursery.
Yeah, Ward's Nursery is at 600 South Main Street in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, or wardsnursery.com.
And Dale Isla Riggs, the Berry Patch.
TheBerryPatch.net. And the self-serve honor system for transplants will start up in the middle of May. We are seeding next week.
Here's a thought. You have a drone up there just watching all the time. Camera drone, you know?
It's called a ring camera.
Exactly.
Right, ring cameras nowadays. That's right.
Fred Breglia, the Landis Arboretum.
Yeah, we're at 174 Lake Road in Esperance, New York, and the website's landisarboretum.org.
Now, remember the Landis Arboretum, because Vox Pop Gardening will be headed to the Landis Arboretum on Earth Day, April 22nd at 2 p.m. for a live taping. It'll be really cool. You can join us for that. Just find out more at wamc.org/on the road. Support comes from the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. And Berkshire Taconic Community Foundation. From scholarships to grants to personal giving plans, Berkshire Taconic Community Foundation, connecting local generosity to help create local opportunity. Learn more at berkshiretaconic.org. Thanks again to Fred, Bob, Greg, and Dale Isla for being here today. Two of the guests have jet lag, and they did great today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. If you didn't get through, my sympathies, but we'll be back in 2 weeks from today and we'll do it again. Thanks to Mike Bowen, our engineer. Andrea Leong, second day in a row, screened the calls. She's a glutton for punishment. Thank you, Andrea. Tomorrow it's Food Friday, and it's Pies with Ellen Gray. I say it again, Pies with Ellen Gray. We'll see you, too.